Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Geert, and once again, I'm your host for today on NBN. And today we are joined by Dr. Nathaniel Morris, historian at UCL. Nathaniel, so, you're very much welcome. I'm very glad you're here.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
Great. So we'll be talking about his 2020 book, Soldiers, Saints, and Shamans, Indigenous Communities and the Revolutionary State in Mexico's Gran Nayar, 1910 to 1940, published with Arizona University Press, and will appear next spring in paperback as well. We just heard this week, so that's very nice. Nathaniel, maybe let's jump right in. Could you tell us about your book? What brought you, in a broader sense, to study the region, and how did you come to write this book finally?
I mean, it all started, I guess, at some point in the early 1970s, when my dad's half brother, on one of several trips around the world, met a woman from the state of Nayarit in the far sort of west of Mexico. They fell in love, eloped, had various adventures along the way, but ended up back in Nayarit, had a bunch of kids, and I grew up hearing stories of my long-lost Mexican family, who I eventually went out to Mexico to meet. I fell in love with all of them and the region in which they live. It helps that they live on the like shores of a volcanic crater lake, and it's exceedingly beautiful in the foothills of the Sierra Madre Occidental mountains. I met at my cousin's bar quite a few Wiraritari, Huichol, indigenous people. And I was studying history at the time, and I asked them a bit about like how the revolution went down. And they told me, you know, some stories of kind of semi-mythical revolutionary bandit leaders who'd roamed the mountains. And when I looked for a book, when I got back to the UK about this history, there was nothing to be seen. And I figured, aha, okay, maybe this could be a project for me. Maybe I could research and write this history. And so it started off like that. And very quickly, the project expanded because I realized that to write the history of this mountainous region where four states kind of meet right in the middle of this sort of confluence of four different Mexican states, Nayarit, Jalisco, Zacatecas, and Durango, it wasn't enough to just write a history of the Nayarit part of the mountains and of the Wirarica and Nayeri or Cora people who live there. I also needed to include the Otodam or Tipiwano people who live just on the other side of the state border in Durango. Also the Wiraritari who live in Jalisco, and also the Mexicanero people who are the smallest of these four indigenous groups and who kind of live scattered between various different communities, like very small communities, right in the middle of all of them. So like, because there was as much contact between, you know, the indigenous people living in Nayarit and their neighbors in Durango, in fact, there was more contact between them than indigenous people in Nayarit and people on the other side of the state of Nayarit. I had to kind of take this area as a whole, which then required, I quickly realized, doing a huge amount of travel because it's a really, really mountainous, fairly remote area. Most of the roads are unpaved. A lot of the roads are actually not roads at all. They're like dusty mule tracks in the summer and kind of swamps in the winter. And not only can you not get a car across, but sometimes you even struggle with a mule. So I walked, I hitchhiked, took the odd bus, couldn't afford to take the little Cessna aeroplanes that missionaries and government functionaries use. So it was a real kind of slow research project, very much rooted in traveling, you know, quite large distances across this really difficult but very beautiful landscape, which, doing my research as I was, right in the middle of some of the fiercest moments of the kind of local drug war, was not always easy. There were roadblocks and random police checks and occasional gunfights and assassinations, and you know, sometimes I'd be planning to go and do research in a community and people would say, right now you probably don't want to go there. Maybe you should just stay here for a couple of days. And, you know, that kind of thing happened a lot, because the area I found out on, you know, many, many different parts of that area are deeply kind of embedded in, the drug trade. They are major opium poppy growing zones. They used to be big marijuana producing areas too. Some of the crystal meth trafficking routes kind of cut through that area also. You know, at night I'd be sleeping on the floor of somebody's like ranch up in the mountains, and you'd hear the buzzing of planes landing at illicit kind of strips somewhere through the forest, and you know, you'd know that there were people with AK-47s kind of at large nearby, and you just kind of had to hope that they weren't suspicious of the like weird white guy in the cowboy hat. And luckily people were really, really lovely, even the narcos, and yeah, everyone was very kind to me. So eventually I amassed enough kind of interviews with the local elders and got invited to take part in local rituals. There's a very, very rich and not particularly Catholic religious life in that area, which is really a key part of political life as well. So over a series of years, you know, I took part in ceremonies and rituals and went on pilgrimages with local people. Attended many fiestas, bought lots and lots and lots of beer for everyone, and, you know, got a sense of what life is like now, which helped me to understand the interviews that I was doing with the old people, who gave me a sense of what life was like then, you know, in the sort of revolutionary era between 1910 and 1940. And then I matched that data up with the results of lots and lots of trips to archives, federal archives in Mexico City, state archives in the local provincial capitals, the agrarian archive in Mexico City as well. Particularly important was the Secretaría de Educación Pública, the education ministry archive, which had all of the reports that teachers had produced on the schools in this region that were set up under the aegis of the revolutionary state's kind of modernizing state building project. And so I, you know, I was able to make sense of these documents using the interviews that I'd done, but then the documents would also give me further questions to then take back to my interviewees, who would then explain, this person that appears in this document, like, yes, you know, here are some details about this person's life. This is what he did or she did. You know, this is how this thing happened. And eventually I kind of ended up with this fairly, I hope, balanced kind of picture of life in the region between 1910 and 1940, you know, which is basically a kind of collage of reminiscences and archival information. Yeah, which, I mean, I'm sure it doesn't seem exactly like history to the local people, who understand history in very different ways. And similarly to sort of rationalist Western historians, it might look a bit like myth and rumor compared to the sort of the straight history that that is still kind of practiced in the West. But like, to me, it seemed balanced enough to to kind of do justice to the whole story of the revolution in this kind of amazing indigenous region of Mexico.
Yeah, very understandable. And if you read your reports, it's very dense. And I'd say, yeah, well, as far as I can judge, triangulated as well. So why did you, because the revolution starts early 20th century, why did you take the whole period of 1910 to 1940, would you say?
Well, again, initially my interest was the revolution with a capital R, between 1910, 1917, there was the overthrow of a dictatorship by revolutionary groups who then ended up fighting one another, and with a military coup in the middle as well. So it was like an armed revolution, lots of like guerrillas running around with rifles and kind of active fighting all over the country, including in these kind of mountain communities in the Gran Nayar. But I realized that the story of the revolution was also, you know, about more than just fighting with guns. There was also a kind of series of political and cultural conflicts that continued all the way through the 1920s and 30s. And in some ways are still kind of ongoing today. But it seemed like looking at the ways in which the governments that came out of the armed revolution tried to create this kind of revolutionary Mexico up until 1940, when the government decided that the revolution was now officially over, and the kind of era of the institutional revolutionary party kind of begins. And that's when, you know, it was decided that the revolution had run its course and it was time to like institutionalize that revolution. So 1940 was kind of a natural cutoff point. It was the era in which a lot of the really big experiments were taken and in which Mexico, as we know it now, kind of really took on a kind of recognizable shape. And so that's kind of when I talk about the revolution in the book, I'm talking about an armed revolution and then a sort of series of revolutionary experiments in creating a new society, a new nation state, a new form of government. And often these experiments kind of clashed with each other. Successive revolutionary leaders undid or redid or kind of radicalized or de-radicalized things that their predecessors had done. And there was a lot of internal factional squabbling at kind of top level between different leaders over the course of this kind of revolutionary political project, all of which are often viewed as like mainly concerning, kind of high level politics in Mexico. But all of these kind of ideological differences had hugely important and often like kind of quite counterintuitive effects on the ground in parts of, you know, the Mexican countryside, in the communities that I study, that's kind of the story that I'm telling.
So the region, as you say, it's remote. It's hard to access, so to say. Like when we talk about this armed phase of the revolution, so 1910, 1917, what was the interaction of the region with the revolution's actors like?
Basically, because it was a fairly remote mountain region, it was an ideal refuge and hideout for the remnants of any defeated guerrilla band, or any defeated formal army that then in its defeat scattered and turned to guerrilla warfare in order to survive. In particular, it became a refuge for defeated remnants of the Villista army, of Pancho Villa's, you know, sort of rebel cowboy army. And in part because the area spans these parts of four different states, there are lots and lots of kind of mountain routes that, that kind of connect bits of Western Mexico to each other, but kind of through a back route. So, you know, you'd have like defeated bands would like retreat to the Sierra and regroup. Steal food from the local Indians, and, you know, like rest and often kind of commit all sorts of abuses as like roving bands of soldiers tend to do. And they would get their strength up and then they'd kind of go on the offensive and leave the area again to attack one of the major cities, like in the plains below these mountains. And then the next group would be defeated and would like head back up into the mountains again. And after a few rounds of this, some indigenous people from this region joined these bands, whether that was in order to obtain weapons or just to like survive. It's better to join the soldiers than just be a constant victim of the soldiers. And other groups kind of petitioned, certain communities got in touch with revolutionary movements active like elsewhere in the country, asked them for guns and then used those guns to defeat the sort of the soldiers who turned into bandits who were terrorizing them. And then often got drunk on their own power and went and invaded the neighboring communities and used their sort of newfound power to do similar things to these roving bands of soldiers themselves, which then caused more communities to arm themselves to like defend themselves from their neighbors. And you get this kind of ramping up of conflict, which means that by the time that in the rest of the country, the revolution is settling down, about 1917, in the Gran Nayar region, it's 1917 when things really start to kind of heat up. Because by this point, everyone has guns. And that's actually the period of the most intense fighting, combined with the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918, which kind of absolutely devastates the region as well, meaning that by the early 20s, the kind of whole place is in ruins, but also kind of is controlled by these warlords who are, whether they are indigenous people or they are part of the local Spanish-speaking mestizo minority, but who have managed to persuade local indigenous people to follow them. They're very much kind of in control in a way that there'd never really been that sort of warlord-led political control in this region before. It had mainly like, except at periods of like, you know, during the civil wars in the 19th century, maybe there'd been a bit of this, but for the most part, the indigenous communities of the Gran Nayar were controlled by basically councils of elderly people who had become like masters at performing the correct rituals to ask for good harvests, good rain, peace and kind of quiet in the region. And so they were these kind of ritual specialists and shamans who oversaw councils that kind of mediated conflict and generally kind of led their communities. And suddenly they, you know, these groups found themselves challenged by these younger men who commanded bands of other armed younger men. And that sort of sets the stage for like a mixture of generational and cultural conflicts that are also inherently political.
I see. And so we're talking about, of course, that's simplification, but we're talking about four indigenous groups, basically. there, can you typify them as some part of them were back in the day already more pro-state, or is that an oversimplification?
A lot of the few historical studies of the region tend to talk about these indigenous peoples as like tribes, basically. And they try to identify behavior that is tribal. But what I found, and I think what is the case today and has long been the case, is that actually communities are more important than communal identity is more important than ethnic identity. Each one of these four groups of, so there are, you know, there are four groups who speak four languages, indigenous languages, and have, you know, four different kind of ethnic religions and generally identify themselves as, you know, members of these ethnic groups. But each one of these four groups is then divided, split between multiple communities, and it's communal identity and belonging that are much more important when it comes to alliances with the state. So amongst the Wirarika people, the Wiraritari, the Huichols, you have one community that becomes quite closely allied with the revolutionary government in the 1920s and 30s. You have another community that is always rebelling. It joins every rebellion against the government that there is. And then the third major Huichol community tries to kind of stay neutral. It doesn't really want to commit to either one or the other side, and as a consequence, find itself constantly attacked by everyone. And so that, you know, that tends to be the rule. The exception is with the Nayeri, Kora people. There was a bit more of a semblance of kind of intercommunal alliances and kind of political behavior on a larger than communal kind of scale, at least at the beginning of this period. Although what I find is that by the 1940s, the consequences of revolutionary policies and local participation in various different rebellions, popular frustration with the slow pace of agrarian reform and with really disruptive schooling policies instituted by the state basically means that the Nayeri people end up fighting amongst themselves to an extent that they never had before. And so having been quite different to the other three groups are suddenly like equally divided between themselves at communal level.
Okay, and I presume that in the 1910s, the concept of caciquismo already emerges, right? That's what you were speaking about earlier.
Yeah, so this kind of warlordism is a local form of a phenomenon known in Mexico as and other parts of Latin America as caciquismo. A cacique is like a kind of boss. And so caciquismo is kind of more or less means boss politics. And it's a quite personalist form of doing politics in which local strongmen amass followers based on personal attributes and often quite a lot of self-interest. And that kind of forms the basis of their like political constituency and struggles over, you know, power, the rights to particular bits of land, and over economic resources, or the right to exploit certain local natural resources, lead to conflict between kind of rival groups of caciques, of local bosses.
What's interesting then, because your third chapter is called is about state building, but I imagine that it's a particularly difficult quest to do state building in an environment that is governed in such a way, right?
Yeah, I mean, essentially because the enemy of your enemy is your friend, but then the enemy of your enemy of your enemy is also your enemy. Like, it all gets very complicated. And so the state, in making alliances with anyone, tends to also end up making an enemy of the enemy of its new ally. And so for every victory that the state has, it also ends up kind of offending or entering into conflict with the neighboring group, which is part of the reason why, as I was saying, like, between the different Huichol communities, there's this constant, one community keeps agreeing to all the government programs, and they like accept teachers into the community, and they volunteer as fighters against the local rebels on behalf of the government. They enter into negotiations over the titling of their lands in accordance with government plans, and are generally very receptive to government programs and very keen to, you know, prove their loyalty through armed service. And so the state does quite well in this particular community, but almost as a direct consequence of its successes there, the neighboring community is constantly fighting against the state, constantly joins rebels in any kind of anti-state rebellion that they can. They don't accept teachers into their community. They ambush federal soldiers. They reject any attempts at land reform, orchestrated by government officials, and generally kind of show themselves to be anti-government wherever possible. In part because of the government's success elsewhere. And this is kind of replicated across the region. And so you have this kind of patchwork of mini kind of states almost, some of which are allied with the government, some of which are kind of intractable enemies of the government, which makes it, very complicated and difficult for the state to really assert its political and kind of cultural power in this region, because for every show of acceptance, there is also a show of resistance. And that's one of the reasons I think that the Gran Nayar is famous today, primarily as a region of quite autonomous, independent-minded, and culturally and ethnically extremely distinct indigenous peoples who still have their own religions. They live in communities in which there is limited acceptance of state schooling. There is frequent resistance to road building projects. Huichol people have led the movement against mining in the Wirikuta region, which has become a kind of cause célèbre amongst all sorts of aspects of the creative, like, Mexican class. This sense of the Gran Nayar as a really difficult region, and as one of the last parts of Mexico that is kind of almost like a wilderness in some ways, is rooted in this like history of conflicts with and resistance to the state. Even though there is also this often unrecognized history of accommodation to an alliance with the state that kind of goes together with the resistance. It definitely makes it very difficult for state officials to really know what's going on there, because that they have success here and then complete failure there. And it, in part, it just means that it's really complicated to plan projects in this area. And so then the projects don't get done. And so then that feeds this sense of otherness and of resistance. And it's in part that, I guess, as well as the geography of the region, that means that the Gran Nayar today is also a major drug production zone, in which, you know, it's very hard for police and soldiers to assert their authority and effectively kind of crack down on drug production. And in part, I guess, why certain groups and certain communities in particular are fairly committed to growing opium and don't have too much of a hard time about cutting deals with narcos and making alliances with cartels, preferentially to alliances with state officials. And yeah,
fascinating. In the second half of the 20s, the area becomes the certain kind of armed resistance emerges again. What's that all about?
So one of the most important strands of the revolutionary political project at high level was to finally break the power of the Catholic Church in Mexico and create a secular kind of quote-unquote modern nation state in which priests no longer had power. The church was seen as a direct rival to state kind of control. And this kind of anti-clerical ideology became federal state policy by the mid-1920s, which led to a growing series of conflicts between the church and the state, and also between just, Catholic kind of grassroots groups who, even if the priests told them, oh, no, don't cause any trouble. We don't need any kind of violent resistance. A lot of peasants didn't listen to the sort of more passive priests and took up arms against what they saw as an attack on not only the church, but on their identity. And by 1927, the beginning of 1927, enough of these small groups of peasants and ranchers had risen up against the state in defense of their identity as Mexican Catholics, it's fair to call this a rebellion or even, a war. It's known as the Cristero Rebellion or the Cristero War or La Cristiada. And it is basically the last really, really big rebellion in Mexican history. Tens of thousands of people rose up against the government, and most of these people are Spanish-speaking mestizo Mexicans who may have had, very recent indigenous ancestry, but regarded themselves kind of primarily as Mexicans and as ethnically mestizo Mexican. In the Gran Nayar, the power of the church had historically been really quite weak. The priests and missionaries of the colonial period had only had very limited success in really converting local indigenous people to a recognizably Catholic religion. And indeed today, the Huichol people in particular are famous for being the least Christian of all of the different ethnic groups in Mexico. They still have their own temples. Their churches are definitely not recognizably Catholic in any way. Shamanism there is in those communities is way more central to local life than any kind of priestly kind of Catholic style religion. And yet, because of local conflicts with state officials, a lot of kind of openly pagan religious, people with shamanic practices who the church regarded as heathens, as actual pagans, ended up joining the Catholic rebels against the government and declaring themselves Cristeros, as warriors of Christ the King against the satanic government. that's, one of the most counterintuitive, results of this revolutionary experiment is that a revolution that publicly proclaims that it has come to liberate the poor and marginalized of Mexico from misery and oppression, and, you know, poverty and superstition, ends up so offending the most marginalized of all of the sort of peasant groups in Mexico, that these pagan Indians join the sort of Mexican equivalent of a sort of Catholic Taliban. Predictably, state officials were quite confused by this, which then led them to view the local indigenous people fighting with the Cristeros maybe as more Catholic than they really were, and to just blame any resistance on fanaticism and superstition, and ignore or like overlook the kind of much more material and political beefs that local people had with state programs, which in the 1930s led the state to like commit all of the same mistakes all over again, which then led a load of local indigenous people to once again take up arms against the government, in what is known as the Second Cristero Rebellion, which in most of Mexico was a much smaller and less important rebellion, but in the Gran Nayar was actually as important, if not more important, than the First Cristero Rebellion. And for basically from 1934 all the way through the 1940s and into, you know, at 1930s rather, and all the way up until 1941, there is quite concerted rebellion and almost a state of civil war in the Gran Nayar.
Is that the joining of the Catholic cause, so to say, is that does that happen uniformly across the whole region?
Just as the state found it very difficult to assert its authority in the Gran Nayar, the Cristero rebels also found that it was very difficult to meaningfully kind of take over this region, because for every community or every faction within a community that joined the Cristero rebels, you know, their enemies would actually decide that the state offered more material or economic or political advantages than the rebels did. And so then end up, you know, fighting on behalf of the state. And so, yeah, you have this kind of civil war scenario throughout the region as, you know, the local people take different sides in this national level conflict and end up fighting it out between themselves. And, you know, while identifying as members of these national level kind of groupings, on the ground, they're fighting a very different war for, you know, very different and much more local regions, reasons.
Yeah. What I found particularly gripping is that you've spoken at least to some people who were there during the Cristero Rebellion, and it seems to still activate quite strong sentiments, not just in the people that tell you about the rebellion, but also people that like live today, like younger people, so to say. It's fascinating how history comes bound up quite quickly with the mythology and the identity of the area.
Yeah, I mean, in part, that's testament to a kind of a very real otherness in this area, the very real difference that there is in the way that indigenous people in the Gran Nayar kind of perceive the world, the universe, you know, reality, when compared to like mainstream Mexican society. So cyclical visions of history have always been, you know, when local people talk about history, they talk about cycles rather than a linear path. They talk about the repetition of events throughout time and space. There's a very different way of understanding the flow of time and the meaning of history and the way in which things play out. And to an extent, these days, kind of Western conceptions of time as more of a linear thing have entered local kind of consciousness, and there's a sense of like history being a kind of chronicle. But there's still also this other like cyclical thing going on. And it means that people are more inclined, I think, in the Gran Neyar than in, than in the plains below the mountains where Mestizo people live, to see the modern violence of the drug war as kind of directly linked to or even part of the violence of the Cristero rebellion and the revolutionary period. These violent kind of periods, to us, to me as an Englishman, they are, these violent episodes appear separated by spans of years. Whereas in the Gran Neyar, there is still a sense that these periods of violence are actually part of a kind of violent cycle of history that bridges gaps in time. And that, La Revolución and La Cristiada and La Violencia y La Guerra, all of these things that we view as separate and distinct, to them are part of a whole. And it meant that it was in some ways, more difficult to do historical research there to begin with, at least, because the idea of history there is just different. And it forced me to kind of slightly reconsider what I was researching in the first place and why it was important. But it also meant, I was able to access like really vibrant kind of traditions and get a sense of the way in which history is important, because in this region, people are still kind of living this history. It's a living thing that people are really part of, and that is part of local identities too.
Maybe because you also said that during your at least during your archival research, you went into the educational board organization, the SCP, I think it's called.
Yes, the Secretariat of Public Education.
Yeah, thanks. So could you say a bit more about their role? I guess toward the end of the book, it becomes more important. What did they try to do down there?
Well, basically, from very early on, the revolutionary government, state that emerged from this period of armed kind of civil war, realized that the only way to forge a new nation and create this kind of new Mexican identity was by going out into the countryside and teaching the peasants that they were Mexicans. It was called explicitly viewed as this process of forging a motherland, forjar patria, forjar patria, I guess, forging the fatherland. So teachers were viewed basically as like the advanced guard of the revolution and of a new Mexican nationality that would triumph over local divisions and very local conceptions of identity and belonging, and bring all of the multiple and very diverse populations that made up, the Mexican people together as one. And in the Gran Nayar, this involved sending out teachers to the indigenous communities to teach their children to speak Spanish, with the idea that hopefully Spanish would replace the local indigenous languages. They would also teach the indigenous people to be more efficient, as defined by the government, in terms of their agricultural production. They would more effectively exploit local resources in order to make Mexico as a whole a richer and more developed nation. If local people primarily grew corn, you know, the state would give them seeds that would, you know, allow them to grow more corn. And like, if there were lots of forests, the state, you know, led by these, the local sort of representatives of the state, the teachers, would bring, you know, saws and equipment that would allow them to chop down more trees so that they could turn the trees into wood that could then be sold, that could then be taxed, that would like create, you know, a better local economy that would then help the national economy. And yeah, the teachers were at the forefront of all of this, and they set up schools and told local parents that the law now stated that they had to send their kids to these schools. And it very quickly proved very, very divisive and controversial because for probably thousands of years, if not even longer, local family units were the essential economic unit. You know, kids helped in the fields. They helped milk the cows, pick the corn, do the weeding, spin the wool into clothes, and generally like were an essential part of local economic life. Which was a life geared towards surviving in areas of poor soil and like limited resources. It was, you know, a subsistence lifestyle that kind of worked. And the idea of suddenly every child being in a classroom, you know, posed a direct threat to local livelihoods. It also posed a direct threat to cultural transmission because, if the young kids weren't hanging out with their parents and grandparents, how were they going to learn the local mythological cycles and how to like be good people in the way in which, you know, they were expected to be in line with the local cultural norms? And so there was a lot of resistance, particularly by more conservative and more elderly people to these kind of school programs. Especially as a lot of teachers turned out to be corrupt, drunks, who beat the children. And, you know, most of these indigenous communities, beating kids was like not actually, that wasn't a cultural practice that they engaged in. It's the idea that their kids were being beaten by teachers was sort of shocking and offensive and got people really riled up. The idea that the teachers were drunks scandalized local morals because often the only teachers that the state could find to send up to these like kind of remote mountains were, you know, the worst scumbag teachers of all, who had like very little training and, you know, very like shady pasts, who often thought that they could make a quick buck by like going up and, you know, to some village and like setting themselves up as caciques. And then because of this resistance, the state doubled down on its strategy and started to forcibly, they call it forcibly recruiting kids for these boarding schools. Local people saw this, I think quite rightly, as kidnapping their children and taking them out of their family units to be literally locked in boarding schools, often in terrible conditions, far away. And so local, you know, the local indigenous people started to move further away from, you know, their villages and to sort of retreat further up into the mountains, out of reach of the teachers and the kind of school inspectors who would come and knock on their doors and take away their children. So then the government started sending military patrols to accompany the teachers on these like recruitment drives. And eventually you have local indigenous people declaring themselves Cristeros and ambushing these military patrols and killing the teachers, which then causes the state officials to double down even further on their prejudices against local people as ignorant and primitive and resistant to all progress. And you have this like ramping up of tensions that I guess become a key driver of the violence during the second Cristero Rebellion, the outbreak of which is accompanied by the burning of a major new school in one of the Otodam or Tepehuano communities in southern Durango. They kidnap a teacher and hold him for ransom and burn this boarding school and announce to all of the local people that they've struck a blow for like local freedom against the the tyrannical government. The government is very confused and sees this as a straightforward Catholics didn't like the secular school, but really it's much more about kind of indigenous identity and morality versus a kind of an interfering not very understanding kind of and very rigid state apparatus.
Yeah. So, well, I guess we've reached the end of the 30-year period. And if I may take a sentence from your epilogue, you say the nature of the regional post-revolutionary settlement it constituted an unsatisfactory compromise between the fundamentally incompatible aims of conservatives and cosmopolitans. What was the situation like at the end? Would you say was it actually like a cutoff in history?
Well, I mean, let's just say there a volume two would definitely be possible. There's a lot more history to be told, there's not. In some ways, there's a cutoff because the government really stops its most extreme political and social and cultural experimentation and settles down to a much more static mode of basically economic-based state building, where they forget about like really trying to change the culture too much and focus more on just empowering the friendliest local caciques that they can find and then using those caciques to basically exploit local resources as best they can. On the other hand, there's very much this unsatisfactory compromise between the state and its like authority has grown by this point in the Gran Nayar. The state is way more powerful in 1940 than it had been in 1910 in this region. But at the same time, local people are more explicitly opposed to the state in many communities, even some communities that had been quite closely allied to and supportive of state programs by the end of this period felt like they'd received no benefit. All they'd received was violence, mistreatment, and the state hadn't made good on its promises to give them legal rights to all of the lands that they claimed belonged to them. State officials had shown themselves be more interested in making money than really like supporting local goals. And so certain communities turned definitively against the state and remain to this day closed off to most state programs and very kind of resistant to any attempt by state officials to enact like developmental policies there. And at the same time, the new form of state building that's all about building sawmills and expanding cattle ranching in this area. Well, those kind of economic developments then cause increased conflict amongst local people who start to understand their lands not just as kind of historic patrimony and the space that they share with spirits and ancestors, and they start to see their forests as sources of income. And so then there's increased tension over who has the right to get that income, which leads to the killing of many of the most powerful caciques, you know, in 1939, are kind of dead by 1945. So there's definitely this unsatisfactory compromise thing going on. There are more mini rebellions. There is the growth of a kind of drug economy, which in part is a direct consequence of the feeling of local people that nature is suddenly a thing that can be exploited for, you know, cash. If you can make more money through growing opium poppy than you can through growing corn, and the whole point that the government's been telling them for 30 years is to like use your resources efficiently, why would you? And it's state officials who were often like in bed with the narcos anyway. Often it's like these drunken teachers who are also encouraging local people to like grow opium poppy because they know that then they can get rich through selling it on to the narcos. Why not? Which then obviously causes the government further problems. And essentially, like, right now, the Gran Nayar is more accessible than it's ever been, but also less accessible. You know, there are better roads. There is narco violence that stops you using those roads. There are more schools, but if you turn up and people, you know, in a community and people think you're a teacher, potentially they don't want to talk to you or have anything to do with you. There is increasing kind of connections now, and more connection than there's ever been before, between local political leaders and the kind of central government. But there is also more local opposition to their own leaders than there's ever been before. And so, you know, everything remains this complicated, fluid compromise that allows a lot of space for local people to maintain cultural and political autonomy and control to an extent over their, you know, ways of seeing the world, of understanding things, and of differentiating themselves from the rest of Mexico, despite what the central government might want.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for giving us this taste of your book, and also giving us a little look into the current situation. I guess you know what the final question will be. You already alluded to volume 2. what are you working on currently?
So I'm currently building on the research that I did for this book, which revealed the presence of militias in these communities throughout the revolutionary period and beyond the revolutionary period. Groups of armed men who claimed, you know, some kind of support from the state and used that to increase their local power. I basically realized through doing the research for this book that these kind of groups are not just limited to the Gran Nayar. There is a long history of militias, paramilitary groups, auxiliary forces who claim to support the government but are actually acting for, their own kind of towards their own goals. And that almost links the story of guerrillas roaming the mountains during the revolutionary period to this current era of drug violence, paramilitarized communities, and, you know, the uprising of the autodefensas in Michoacán, of the rise of kind of armed communal autonomous police forces in Guerrero, the Policía Comunitaria. So I'm trying to research as far as COVID allows, and to begin now writing up a history of basically non-state armed groups in Mexico that will link this revolutionary story to the story of civilian resistance to drug cartels now. Because although drug cartels attacking communities is a fairly new thing, bandits have been attacking communities, cattle rustlers have been attacking communities, rival communities have been attacking other communities, for the entire 20th century and way back into the 19th century. And there have been responses to that that look very much like the Autodefensa or Policía Comunitaria movements, all the way through Mexican history too. So yeah, joining up those dots. And it's moving slowly because of the pandemic, but hopefully another year or two, I will have that book completed and I'll be ready to get back to the more specific Gran Nayar related things for a second volume of more soldiers, more saints, and more shamans.
Even more. All right. Thanks once again. I can't wait. And who knows? We'll talk again next time.
Thank you.
Have a great Friday, Nathaniel.
Yeah, you too. It's been an absolute pleasure.